remind me to tell you a story about this song Day Tripper by the Beatles when we have a little bit more time on that. Mark Newman is our guest, candidate for Congress in Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District. As we've done with previous candidates, we're going to go through issues, and we'll do them in fairly much the same order so that folks can really kind of compare apples to apples. And so while Dr. Newman obviously has a preference for and a respect for healthcare issues, we're going to hit a couple of other areas first, and we're going to start with the economy and inflation. As we've said before, Wisconsin constituents need a functional Congress for a multitude of reasons. Senator Tammy Baldwin talked to us in our last hour about the Inflation Reduction Act and the many things that that can do to help families who are, you know, trying to make ends meet. So, Mark, let me ask what you believe Congress can do and what you will advocate for to help Wisconsin families and entrepreneurs to have secure economic circumstances.
You know, Pat, I like the way you frame that as we need a functional government. We need a functional Congress in order to face up to the realities that people are experiencing. And the pain of inflation, when prices go up and wages don't go up relatively at the same rate, is immensely difficult for all of us. And that's the world we live in day by day and immediately. And it's the one that we experience to be most disturbing. And, you know, our government does things like monetary policy and some of the things that are in the new Senate bill, Inflation Reduction Act. But I like to go further. You know, these things that supply chain and, what we talk about, you know, trying to survive and go beyond the pandemic, all of these are contributors to the stress of our economy right now. But I like to go further. And that is to recognize that we have a deeper problem in our economy and that we've seen over the last decades getting worse and worse and evolving more and more. And what I call that is the me, myself, and I theory, or the me, myself, and I orientation. We become more and more individualized in our approach to public policy. And the notion that everybody is going to do good if everybody just does what they need to do selfishly as individuals. And what we see happening is we have more and more wealth being concentrated into fewer and fewer hands, and we have no balance against that. I just learned 2 days ago that the three most wealthy families in America and the United States have the equivalent wealth of 150 million people, the lower economic 150% of our economy. And this type of imbalance is, I believe, at the heart of the stress that we feel right now, because the wealthy and the powerful control what goes on in our legislature. And we all know that how money influences the campaign season and how our legislators end up being caught up in that system in order to survive as members of the Congress. They think that they have to carry water for the wealthy folks. And wealth has a way of making itself wealthier. If we have a little bit of power, we can get more power more quickly than someone who doesn't. And the only way to balance that off, that phenomena in every market economy, is to have a strong government that can have a tendency to balance that concentration of power. And unless we can do that, we end up with fewer and fewer people actually pulling the strings and running what we would like to believe is a widely shared governance of the people, by the people, and for the people. And instead of having that, instead of having this dream of democracy, we end up having what we have to call an oligarchy, a functional oligarchy, where the strings and the puppeteers are being pulled by those who have the concentrated wealth.
Am I hearing, in terms of an economic, you know, impact proposal from you, is it essentially that does it come back to something like, you know, the tax code? We know what we've talked about, what Ron Johnson's impact has been on the tax code, that it needs to be better balanced so that, you know, the super wealthy are paying a fair share, and then that's what funds, you know, the programs that benefit everybody else? Or is there more to it than that?
That's absolutely correct. I mean, you put the hammer right on the nail. We need a progressive taxation formula, and it's like what other wealthy countries do. And people say, well, they have a 70% taxation rate. Well, what the heck? If you have a 70% taxation rate on the, you know, the higher brackets, but everybody is living a flourishing life. What else do you want? So unless we can do that, and we've done that in the past, our country has had higher taxation brackets and higher earners, but we also have problems that there are many people who are very wealthy, but it doesn't show up as normal earned income that is taxed by income tax. So we have to have other mechanisms. And these are talked about, you know, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. Of course, they talk about these things. These are possible, but we have to have the political will to do that. And it's not so much so that we have resources to pay for services, but actually that we are conserving and preserving our democracy in order to do this.
I think one of the, you hit at something that I think has been one of the biggest flaws in public messaging over the decades, is explaining how marginal tax rates work. That when it, back way back when you had a 70% tax rate, that didn't mean all 70% of your income was taxed. It was 70% of that particular margin, which might be $1 million or more. And that's still a nice chunk of change that's left over, and it's what grew the middle class. Let's turn now to the rural economy. This is a district that remains very concentrated with farming operations, family farms, and then all of the people and the industries that support agriculture. The environment certainly has changed since the days when, you know, Steve Gunderson represented the district, and we talked pretty much just about milk prices. There's so much more to it. So as you've traveled up and down that district and talked to people about what a congressional representative needs to be mindful of for Western and Central Wisconsin's farmers, what are your priorities and plans there?
Well, a lot of public policy for our rural communities comes through the, you know, the Farm Bill that's been in existence since the 40s with Henry Wallace, when we were helping people to recover from the Dust Bowl experiences in the Depression. But unfortunately, over these decades, it has become more and more advantageous for corporations. And the concentration of power into corporations and the dissipation of support for the smaller operators. And we end up seeing in our countryside that our farming operations are dying. And or I should rather say that the community, the social network, the social infrastructure, the social value is being dissipated, so that from a social perspective, it becomes a bit of a life lost community. We lose small businesses, we lose our churches, we lose our health facilities, we lose our schools, when populations are leaving because they have been unable to sustain their smaller operations. And this makes us also vulnerable to stress when we have large operations that are producing a product that gets shipped overseas because that's where the way the Farm Bill sort of favors things. And in the end, it's very understandable to me that people who live for generations in our rural regions can feel that they've been ignored, left behind, and can feel resentful of the way things have evolved. And so what we need is to orient our policy towards the life of people in the rural regions and not simply towards the production of product that we can sell overseas. And we need to counteract the effects of the monopoly suppliers and the monopoly processors that squeeze the small operators just for profits on the supply side and then on the processing side. So it's a definite need. It has to be addressed directly. And it gets back to that same notion I said earlier, when power is concentrated in a few hands, the little guys, they just get ignored.
That concentration of power has also been an impediment to addressing a changing climate, which is important not only to our agriculture, but to pretty much every aspect of life. Tell us what you would do as a congressional representative for Western Wisconsin in the area of climate mitigation and also trying to prevent future harm.
We have a need in front of us to adapt and to mitigate the effects of climate change. I think all of us, even in our short lifespans of 6 or 8 decades, can see definite differences in the weather patterns, which bring it home to us that what scientists have been telling us for 50 years, 40 years, has come home to roost. And so now it's apparent to us that we need to make these interventions. Simply stated, we need to stop producing and adding more carbon dioxide to our atmosphere. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, we had 280 parts per million of carbon dioxide. This is the heat retaining gas in our atmosphere. And now we have 420 parts. We've gone up that much. And a lot of it has been contributed by the American economy, the United States economy over the last 50 to 100 years. And so we Americans have an elevated responsibility on planet Earth to be leaders in the response to this climate crisis that's affecting all 8 billion people that live on this planet. And it's our responsibility to be leaders, to take up that role of the most powerful government in the world, leading the community of nations. When that bleeds back to us in Wisconsin, certainly our federal government is providing resources like we talked about earlier, that Senator Baldwin, with the bill that's before the Senate right now, that would have practical implications and applications in our local state economy to help us transition off of fossil fuel-based energy sources to non-fossil-based energy, so the green sources of energy. It's simple. We just have to get off of fossil fuel as our main source. And we need a lot of energy. That is true. And we just have to move forward and use the technology that's available, but with a concerted and determined effort to get there.
But how difficult that still must be, that, you know, what you just said over the past couple of minutes can be blunted by, you know, a 30-second commercial from the petroleum industry about how, you know, that would be too expensive. We can't afford to do that when we've already got gas everywhere. People hear that and they tell you, I think it would be too expensive. It might cost me my job or higher taxes. In the, you know, less than minute that we have till break, what do you tell them about that?
Right. Once again, you've identified a core issue. What is it, Texaco? I'm thinking which company it was that had a concerted effort to distort the information coming out from our scientists since the 80s. It was Tenneco, where they actually had a campaign of marketing to confuse our public discussion. And that is very unfortunate for us, until it became all just completely unavoidable for people to recognize the danger. And I think that as a government, you can have an authority to stop information, poor information, distorting information that in handicaps the political community to make good decisions.
If only it were that easy to fight misinformation and outright disinformation. That is a battle you and I and others will be waging for some time to
come. That's what you're doing.
There you go. Mark Newman is our guest candidate for Congress. We're going to take our break here at the bottom of the hour. We'll be back in a couple of minutes with more right after this. You're up north.